This is the binary edition of Radio Freethinker, episode 96.
Hello and welcome to Radio Freethinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver and, of course, also heard on CFBX in Kamloops. This is Ethan, your freethinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. And this is me, the ghost of Chloe Past. And this is me, the ghost of Daniel Past. As you noted in our intro, I mentioned this is a binary edition of Radio Free Thinker. That means you get the pleasure and the joy of having just me and Ethan here today, as Daniel and Chloe have gone off to pursue their academic desires.
The absolute pleasure of me and Don talking to you into your radio.
Hello, wow.
Hello, hello.
So how was your week, Ethan?
You know, it was a pretty good week, relaxing, except that I went to take back a printer to local printer selling store. Stood in line for about an hour and a half, but got to take it back, got a new one, prints wirelessly, and double-sided.
Wow. Yeah. I hear that wireless one is quite good because you can download ink directly to it from the interweb.
Yeah, it really saves money. Really, really good.
You know, times they are changing. And, you know, speaking of changing times, we did an episode a little while back about the decriminalization and legalization of drugs. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we used as sort of a point there was Portugal. Well, recently Portugal has released some studies about its success. Now, apparently at the end of the 20th century, roughly 100,000 people in Portugal were addicted to drugs. That amounted to about 1% of the country's population. Faced with this, holy crap, there's so many people addicted to drugs in our country, Portugal in 2000 took the historic step of decriminalizing all drugs. They went with the idea of taking the money that they're going to save on the quote-unquote war on drugs and put it into treatment. Now, to be fair, in Portugal, drugs are still illegal. But when you are sort of convicted of a charge, what happens is you get sent to counseling or to treatment instead of being sent to prison. The idea is to switch from the mentality of criminalizing the issue into a public health issue and preventing users from going underground. I mean, if something is illegal and you're going to go to prison, you're going to do your best to hide, where if it's sort of a health issue, you might want to seek treatment. So today in Portugal, there are a lot of outreach health workers who sit there and they provide fresh needles, swabs, even dishes to cook up your injectable material, which I think is quite a, I don't know, just when you sit there and you say safe injection site, I don't think of them handing out little peachy dishes or spoons to mm-hmm. cook your crack, but apparently do, and of course disinfectant and condoms. If you are caught with drugs, and apparently any amount of drugs can do this, you are sent to what is called a dissuasion committee for counseling, which of course is just social workers, psychologists, and they basically said, really, what do you want to do with your life? Mm-hmm. Don't you want to get help? Apparently, if you fail to show up at one of these committee meetings, they can fine you. In serious cases, it can actually lead to mandatory treatment. So it's not like they decriminalized it and said, have at it. You know, they are actively trying to make sure that, you know, drugs don't become a problem, but they're going at it from a very different way. Now, apparently, like I say, they've released a report which is up to 2008, and what's happened in Portugal? Well, apparently there has been a small increase in illicit drug use among adults, because of course you grew up with that culture. But apparently in adolescents and in problem users, like addicts and prisoners, rates have gone down. Drug-related court cases have dropped by 66%, which, again, someone asked me, this was kind of a weird question. They said, well, yeah, but if you decriminalized it, wouldn't that mean there should be no criminal court cases? But as I say, they still kind of go to court. They just don't go to prison. So So the fact that you're getting less repeat customers.
I see.
They also noted that HIV cases have dropped by 75%. So in 2002, 49% of people with AIDS were addicted. Now it's only 28%. And I'm assuming some of those might have died, but there are no new cases taking place. The number of regular users have held steady at less than 3% for the population for marijuana and less than 0.3% for heroin and crack cocaine users. Now, essentially, this number is important because it shows that, you know, once you decriminalize it, there wasn't suddenly a swath of people suddenly becoming addicts, right? So the usage rate has remained pretty much stable. And the number of people who are actually treated for drug addiction has rose by 20%. So those people are actively trying to make themselves better. Has increased. In Switzerland, where addicts are supervised in injection sites, kind of like what we have here in Vancouver in our safe injection site, I still think that's open, addictions have steadily decreased because addicts have the opportunity to receive counseling and to know that there's a way out. And apparently no one has died there since they started this, 1994. Quite a good success. Now, contrast this with the United States, which has waged a 40-year war and spent over $1 trillion on its drug war. Each year, they spend $74 billion on criminal and court proceedings against drug offenders, compared to $3.6 billion for treatment. I mean, you sit there and you go, well, obviously, it's a big business to keep them in prison. However, apparently, and I was stunned when I learned this, that in the United States, they do have quote-unquote drug courts, which offer nonviolent drug offenders the choice between going to prison or getting treatment. And in San Francisco, where I have a number from, apparently the city saves roughly a little over $14,000 per offender. That if you expand this to cover all the drug offenders in the United States, apparently 1.5 million, it would cost $13 billion to do it. But the payback, or the amount you would save, is up to $40 billion. So again, it seems to make, you know, a lot of sense. Another thing that I also noticed, which was just kind of curious, that apparently the U.S. Has the highest per capita population of prisoners at over 756 per 100,000. Do you know what the number two one is?
India.
Yeah, well, it's a good guess. Number two is Russia, which has 629. That's like almost one-seventh less, right? But over 50% of those people incarcerated in the United States are for drug offenses. So, you know, and that's including things, you know, like murder. Hey, I killed him for drugs. No, that would be a violent crime. Or I stole his money. That's a thing. It struck me that, you know, in one sense, that this decriminalization, one, there's more than one way to do it. So you don't have to go full blast and legalize it like some people have. But just by shifting that mentality from making drug users criminals to seeing it as a public health issue has so many possible positive outsets. Whether or not you think using drugs is right or wrong, it's better for society, or it seems to be anyhow. There's some empirical evidence pointing
that. If you look
at
it from a purely sort of utilitarian point of view, cost effectiveness, the cost on the public health care system, the time and energy of law enforcement, it makes a lot of sense regardless of how you view drug use, whether it's good or bad. So, I mean, you don't necessarily have to be like, oh, we're just going to open the door, let the floodgates come and whatever. You can do this from a point of view of let's maximize our law enforcement, our time spent, and the safety of our health care system. So,
and I suspect that most countries, if they actually provided, you know, government venues to purchase the drugs, would eliminate that next step, right? Because you've eliminated sort of the problem from users. So it's a health issue, you need to do that. But there's still a criminal element supplying it. Mm-hmm. And I still think that's another area to be dealt with. But again, what's the best model? Time will tell. But I think this is an excellent data point in anyone who is trying to create a polyskeptic case for legalization or decriminalization of drugs.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, moving on, we actually have some very, very bad news to report. Today in Pakistan, Salman Taseer, the governor of Punjab, was murdered. Taseer was an outspoken secular politician who was shot dead by a fanatic who opposed the reform of the country's draconian blasphemy laws. Now, last month, Taseer caused a lot of controversy by supporting Asai Bibi, a Christian woman and mother of three who had been sentenced to death for allegedly insulting Muhammad. The case itself triggered a lot of debate around the blasphemy laws. Now, have we confirmed, I don't know if we know for sure or not, whether or not the woman was in fact executed?
Well, that's it. Yeah, I had heard this morning on a newscast that they had said that she was killed. Mm-hmm. But I haven't been able to confirm that. And if any of our listeners out there who know more of the details about this particular woman's case, they should email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. Because again, I think, you know, there have been lots of laws that have put blasphemy as a crime, at least in a number of countries. But somehow that next elevation to making it a capital offense and then actually killing someone for it, would just strike me as that step too far.
I mean, one of the huge problems with blasphemy law, as I think we would see it and as many sort of secular organizations would look at this, is that it allows the censure of unwanted religious criticism and gives free rein to justify aggressive human rights violations as divine mandates. Now, typically these laws are used to silence complaints of minorities and provide legal penalties for speaking out against the reigning authority. They also suppress freedom of expression by giving religion a special place in society that is somehow above the laws and above the debates and above the criticisms that all other ideologies and policies are under in the marketplace of ideas. Later in the show, we're going to be discussing the role of ethics and science. If there's one person who has made the case that religion cannot be above the laws of society, it's Sam Harris. And I think this is actually a really strong indictment that Sam is maybe got the right idea here. I think that blasphemy laws here are just being used to the worst possible way in Pakistan right now.
You know, I also think on that note, in a way, this woman could have been put in an impossible situation because, I mean, the blasphemy laws, I mean, if she was a Christian, I mean, if she was a Muslim mm-hmm. and she did this, I still think it would be wrong, but at least it would have been consistent.
Yeah.
But, I mean, if they're sitting there saying, well, you have to acknowledge that the prophet is the prophet of God or whatever, and that is a non-Christian concept to have, if she does acknowledge that, then she's sort of guilty of blasphemy against the Christians.
Yeah.
And if she doesn't, then it's blasphemy. And depending on how these laws are worded, which, of course, obviously Pakistan, I'm assuming, sees only Muslim blasphemy as blasphemy and any other kind of blasphemy is not.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's also troubling when we consider that recently the UN has been petitioned to adopt anti-blasphemy laws. How will that affect... I mean, the UN is a multinational organization. How is that going to affect people blaspheming? I mean, I like to blaspheme all the time. I do it quite frequently. So, you know, this is just a huge, huge issue. And the murder of Taseer is just, I think, a horrible step in the wrong direction.
Well, you know, and there's also now the next consideration above and beyond these blasphemy laws. Here it was, he was an elected representative, wasn't he? Or he was a government official.
He was a government official. He was appointed to his position as governor, but he was a politician. He ran for office.
Right. So here you have someone who was summarily executed by a lone individual, right? I mean, it was one of his own bodyguards who had done this.
Yeah.
Right? And I mean, that is a chill in itself that someone can, just because they feel they have, quote unquote, the word of God in their hands, can eliminate a public official in such a manner. It's bone chilling in that aspect as well, above and beyond the blasphemy aspect of it.
Well, the fact that he was killed by one of his own bodyguards, who was a member of a supposed sort of elite protection unit, shot him, I believe, 9 times. And before surrendering himself to his colleagues, of course, he told photographers that he was proud to have killed Taseer because he was a blasphemer. So, I mean, you're seeing an incredibly violent expression of religious faith that not only is a personal faith, but is a faith that is saying, you have to agree with my faith. It can't be my personal thing. It has to be something that I enforce on others. And this sort of taking the law into your own hands when it comes to religion is shockingly awful. And I I hope that free thinkers and skeptics and humanists out there are enraged and horrified by this, because this simply cannot be allowed to happen.
Well, you know, and again, we'll get into more of this later in the show, but it also shows, I don't know, the hypocrisy or whatever, is that to sit there and to defame the name of the prophet or whatever, right, is immoral, but to kill someone in cold blood who trusted you, mm-hmm. well, that was moral.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I mean, what kind of compartmentalization, what kind of mental acrobatics does one have to go through in order to think that you can have a moral stream, that your moral landscape can be pure in that?
You know, I want to close on just a little tidbit here. Tassier was known to take his uncompromising stance on secularism to the internet. And he was quite famous for using Twitter as a way of getting his message out there. One of his last remarks on Twitter, I'm going to quote it for you here. "I was under huge pressure to cow down before righteous pressure on blasphemy. Refused, even if I'm the last man standing." So I think that's a pretty poignant way to go out on. Let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and be back with more after this.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will get you discounts on Main Street at Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear,
Woo Vintage,
The Kiss Store, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl,
Flaming Angels Boutique,
and The Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus, or visit us online at citr.ca.
Welcome back to the show here, Radio Free Thinker on CITR. So what else is making news in the skeptical world?
Well, on a positive note, sort of, do you like your vegetables, Ethan?
I do. I like them a lot.
Do you eat vegetables lots?
Yes, I do.
Well, apparently you, as a human, I am assuming you are a Homo sapien, or Homo sapien sapien, to be specific.
Sure.
That you're not alone when it comes to eating vegetables. New research published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science found that Neanderthals, prehistoric cousins of humans. I'm surprised they had to mention that in a scientific journal, but they did. Apparently, they ate grains and vegetables, as well as meat. In fact, they went so far as to say that they cooked them over fire in a similar, if not the same way, that humans did. Researchers have found a number of grains from numerous plants, including wild grasses, as well as traces of roots and tubers, trapped in the plaque buildup on fossilized Neanderthal teeth unearthed in northern Europe and Iraq. The plants seem to be legumes, date palms, and grass seeds such as rye, barley, and wheat. So essentially, thankfully, Neanderthals had very poor dental hygiene. And because of that, they had a buildup of tooth plaque and all that. And from that, they were able to determine that Neanderthals had to have eaten plant material. There's been a lot of debate about whether Neanderthals ate plants or not, because they had found pollen and they'd found other sort of secondary evidence about it, but they never actually found any on their cooking utensils or any of their, you know, tools and all that. So they said, well, sure, they had plants around, but they didn't actually eat it. Well, this is definitive proof that they had to have been eating plant material, because it was literally in their mouth and it was chewed on, and I'm not sure what more proof you could get besides the Zapruder film showing them eating it.
Right.
Many of the particles had gone, you know, physical changes that had matched experimental cooking of starches. So not only were they eating the grains, but there's also a certain thing like where starches become gelatinized, and this can only happen if it's been cooked for example, like in boiling. So what is it? Evolutionary
psychology?
Psychology. We'll sit there and say, well, how do you determine behavior based on physical evidence? And, well, this is one of the ways you can. We now can say with a large degree, if not an absolute degree of certainty, that not only did they eat plants, but that they were cooking it. When I was doing research for this, I also discovered that Spanish researchers say that they had found a gene in modern humans that make certain plants sort of bitter. It's called phenethylcarbamide, but that this gene was also present in Neanderthals. Now, this is the chemical that makes some people think Brussels sprouts taste really, really bitter, and other people can't taste it. It's not a dominant gene. It's a recessive gene. But right. Do you like Brussels sprouts?
You know, I'm not a big fan of Brussels sprouts. However, I do like my green vegetables like broccoli and such. So I think it might just be a personal taste when it comes to Brussels sprouts.
Well, that's the thing. Apparently, I mean, I do like Brussels sprouts. And I think I do taste the bitterness, but I like that bitterness in the same way some people like bitterness of chocolate or whatever.
Right, right.
But apparently this same chemical that's found in Brussels sprouts is also commonly found in a lot of poisonous plants. So there's sort of an evolutionary pressure, you know, to make people have this gene so they avoid eating the plants. And of course, the subtext to this is that Neanderthals must have been eating somewhat of a similar diet, at least to some humans, because, you know, the evolutionary pressure that made us have this gene also made them have the similar adaptation. So again, more evidence that they were eating plants and that they were trying to avoid quote-unquote bad plants. Because if they weren't eating plants at all, then they wouldn't have no need for this gene at all.
Right.
Now, this all being said, as I said before, there hasn't been any evidence so far found on their tools, or at least most of the research I did says, you know, we haven't found, you know, cutting tools that have animal plant material on it besides perhaps cutting of weapons and all that. So they probably didn't practice any kind of agriculture as we know it, and they may have just, you know, partaken of quote-unquote meals of opportunity, the sort of gathering part of hunter-gatherer.
Right, right.
This is important in a big way because chemical analysis of their bones has suggested that they ate little or no vegetable. That the studies represent, this contradicts other studies because the chemical analysis shows that they have a huge amount of protein and very little of other sort of material in there. And they assumed it was because they just ate meat. Well, now it seems like maybe they got some of that protein from plant material. And I think this is quite relevant because, you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, science will get it wrong sometimes, right? And in a way, the chemical analysis shows, hey, they must have gotten it wrong somehow. But science is a self-correcting mechanism. So as we continue to do more research, we find evidence that contradicts previous evidence, and we have to somehow make them both agree. And we don't do it just by saying, oh, it's a miracle. You know, they're going to have to go back and they're going to have to say, well, maybe we missed something in our chemical analysis that we weren't looking for because we made a bad assumption. Because, like I say, this tooth evidence is rather definitive that they had to have been eating plant material, and it directly contradicts what we thought the chemical evidence was saying. So we're going to learn a whole bunch of new things about how to interpret chemical evidence about bone and tissue fragments that we get from prehistoric people. That will infect humans as well as Neanderthals and Devonians, I think, Dysonians, the people we talked about last week.
Right, right. Well, another good reason why scientific knowledge should not be based on dogma. Excellent. Well, and now for something completely different. Scientists are baffled by a bizarre phenomenon that occurred early in the new year in Arkansas. Yes, baffled because over 2,000 birds suddenly fell out of the sky dead.
I know. It's not stunning at all. It's obvious. Anyone who was around on November 2nd knows that the GOP won huge amounts. And let's just face it, this year the GOP is taking office and the birds said, screw it, we're not living with them in power, and they just commit mass suicide.
Yeah, because birds are well known to be Democrats.
You know, from what I understand too, this isn't an isolated. This is actually becoming much more of a mystery because more of it has been occurring.
Yeah. So around midnight, New Year's Eve, thousands of red-winged blackbirds and at least one duck plummeted to the earth for no obvious reason. Within just a few minutes, over the space of about a kilometer and a half, it was raining birds.
5,000 was the last number I heard.
Yeah, it was quite high. So they start falling on like houses and lawns, and people are calling the police, and they're going, "Oh my God, birds are falling from the sky! What's going on?" So they sent out, you know, wildlife experts and cops and vets and all that sort of thing. And an officer responding to an emergency call reported that he arrived on the scene as birds were still falling around him. Some of them were still alive. By daybreak, they had workers in hazardous material suits out there scooping up the birds off lawns, roofs, and everywhere else, taking them to, I guess, the vet for autopsies. And they didn't know why this was happening, so that's why they were wearing hazmat suits. Many people were really concerned. They thought it might be like a virus or a toxin, so they weren't even letting their kids outside. They were pretty panicking. So there's been all kinds of speculation. What could cause this? What happened? What's going on here? And you got things like poisoning all the way over to, like, bad weather.
No aliens?
No aliens so far.
I've been looking at the story, and I've been so disappointed.
Yeah, me too.
That there hasn't been any aliens. I mean, they've used a lot of wacky theories, but where are the grays?
I think the craziest one I saw, which I'm pretty sure was a joke, was somebody posting about, oh, this is, you know, God is doing this because of such and such happening, and it sounded like a joke, so I couldn't take it seriously. But one suggestion was that a flock of birds was hit by lightning. Now, this theory has been ruled out when tests came back on the dead birds. I guess there was no burn marks or something. Because of these test results, poisoning was also ruled out. And so now they're thinking, okay, well, maybe something to do with the noise, because it is New Year's after all. Some speculate that fireworks could have spooked the birds. Another theory is that the birds were sucked up by a convection current in the storm. Because of the storm, you get all these birds flying around. They can't fly straight because of all the wind currents, so they're getting all disoriented and crashing into things.
Well, and also another thing that there was a theme in this is apparently blackbirds, which is the predominant, well, almost all of them were blackbirds except for the one duck who might have been a victim of being hit by a whole bunch of blackbirds.
Possibly.
Have very poor night vision. So at night, once they're up in the air, they're sort of flying blind, which just adds to their trouble.
Yeah, and that's one of the big things as well. The other theory that was sort of floating around, aside from sort of like bad weather, storm weather, you know, heavy rain or hail or something, was that if they are flying around at night, if the birds' feathers get wet, they will freeze to death. Usually they can survive if they're close together or if they're out there for a little bit, but if their feathers get soaked, and it soaks into their skin, they're not especially durable. They will freeze to death. So that's another possibility. But an answer appears to have been found. A local resident reported hearing about 20 loud booms Saturday night, which could have either been fireworks or possibly a cannon, which apparently they used to get rid of nuisance birds, which apparently this backfired a little bit, and saw a huge flock of frantic birds when he went outside. And as Don mentioned, blackbirds have very poor night vision, and they could have been killed because they bang into houses and trees or each other at night. So the theory could be here that a loud noise startled the birds. They took off into the night where they couldn't see well, encountered bad weather conditions, freezing temperatures and wind currents, couldn't fly straight, crashed into each other, died of fright, landed on the ground, people panic. But I think a relatively mundane situation, not warranting conspiracy theories.
Well, see, so here's my conspiracy theory.
Okay.
Well, actually, it's not. It's one of those things that if you're a curious individual, you have to ask. This is a huge number, and I don't remember the last time I've heard of this number of birds dying. I have heard that. I was reading, doing some research, and apparently something like 50 geese got killed in Manitoba in the 1930s. That, although this is maybe a rare thing, it has happened. But I mean, if it's just a loud boom that kills the birds, you'd think it would have shown up. I mean, it wouldn't have been that rare of an event, or someone said, oh yes, last year we lost 500 because of this or whatever. Mm-hmm. And couple on this, just upriver of the Arkansas River from this town of BB, Arkansas, apparently over 1,000, what do they call them, drumfish, started floating up dead, and they're going, is there a connection between this? And then I was just reading this morning that downstream in Louisiana, over 500 blackbirds and starlings were found in dead in Louisiana under similar sort of condition, which, I mean, on the one hand, if it was a boom, okay, so the boom killed the one birds, another boom killed the other birds. But it seems to be one of those things that's just ready-made for the conspiracy theorists out there. Sure. And even if it's not a conspiracy, it is something that it's a noodle scratcher.
It's very strange. I mean, yeah. It is definitely, this is a weird story. You know, I was kind of thinking about it before, and, you know, the blackbirds, they're kind of unique in that when they, I guess, roost together, there's a lot of them. They're not really like, I don't know if we have a bird that's sort of similar here in locally in BC, but apparently also these birds will not be missed. They're like a nuisance in this part of America. So it might actually be that people were not too worried about, you know, lighting off fireworks or setting off cannons or whatever it is they do to celebrate the new year.
Well, that was one of the things when they mentioned poison, right? Because they thought, well, again, because it is sort of a nuisance bird in parts of the United States, they thought, maybe someone's poisoned. But that was ruled out, one, because they had done autopsies. But two, a lot of the local animals said, hoo-hoo, feast. Yeah. And they've been eating the birds like there's no tomorrow.
And they haven't been dying.
And they haven't been dying. You know, I think one of the saddest episodes of all this, and I feel so sorry, for someone like me, and I look at the American media quite a bit, and I know there's Fox News on the right, and there's kind of MSN in the middle of the left, and CNN has been kind of, well, are we going to go crazy? Are we going to go sane? Well, apparently on Anderson Cooper, they had Kirk Cameron of Family Ties fame. I think it's, no, what
no,
is it?
It was
Growing Pains.
Growing Pains, and whatever.
Yeah, but more famous recently because he was the one who helped promote
the new Bible, or the
Origin of Species.
Yes, with the added
right
pages.
And he's a big star apparently in the Left Behind series of movies. I didn't know they made a lot of Left Behind movies. But they had Anderson Cooper on there saying mysterious bird deaths and talking about all these bird deaths, a sign of the apocalypse. And Kirk Cameron is a nut. He's religious crazy. I don't like him. He's a bad person. But I'm going to give him props because this is what he says, and I shall quote, "Well, I first think that you ought to call a veterinarian and not me. You know, I'm not the religious conspiracy theory go-to guy, particularly, but I think it's really kind of silly to try and equate birds falling out of the sky with some kind of end-of-times theory." I'm going, well, you are the end-of-times crazy guy.
Yeah, you are the conspiracy go-to guy.
And when you come out and you say, you know, guys, birds die all the time. Just deal with it. I was quite impressed by this crazy person having a moment of clarity.
Yes. Well, if only they would have more of those. Why don't we go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with more after this.
Hi, this is Randy Randall from No Age. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. Thanks a lot.
The state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
And we're back on Radio Freethinker. So we mentioned earlier in the show that we're going to be talking about ethics and science. And the reason we're talking about this is there's a book out by Sam Harris, The Moral Landscape, where he talks about taking science into the realm of morals, ethics, and deciding things like what ought one should do.
Yeah, essentially, there's always been this dichotomy in philosophy that science has its place, that, and, you know, in the area of pure science, right, like physics and math, science has its place. Other people think that things like in the social sciences, it can be useful, but you have to be careful. And in areas like, you know, ethics and morality, that we should totally reject science as a means of determining what is moral and immoral, ethical and ethical. To this, of course, I reject it. I consider it theological thinking. I think that this idea of thinking is rooted in the past in an attempt to create space for God. And in the old days, to sort of accommodate the coexistence of science in now more modern times, of religion in a society that's becoming more and more secular, more and more scientifically based. So let's confront the very first issue here that sort of is brought up, is can science determine the ought from the is? Now, in most traditional sense, when we look at science, we say science will tell us what is happening, you know, the way things are now, and not the way things ought to be or should be. Mm-hmm. And in the very basic sense, that's actually quite true. Science can go out there and they can say, well, you know, people are healthier if they eat more vegetables than red fatty meat, and that's a valid thing to say. But does this lead to what we ought to do? And like I say, I think it can. In fact, that very example I used points to the idea of where we ought to do. Now, in Sam Harris's book, he has essentially two main premises that he works upon. One is that some people have better lives, or what he will call wellness or the like, than others. And that these differences are not arbitrary, and that they are somehow lawful in the idea of science laws, are related to states of the world and to states of mind. And that in this way, you know, science can actually provide a window onto it. Further, when he goes on, and I'm going to be rifting between me and him on this, so bear with me, that if you reject this idea, what you ultimately come up with then is what they call philosophical relativism, that you have no real foundation to say that this is moral and this is immoral, because then it all just becomes opinion. I mean, that's a downside of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, any philosophical argument that's purely rooted in philosophy may be a great logical argument, may be held up in logic, but its premises become opinion. And his idea is that science may not be at the stage in its development where it can say for certainty this is good or this is bad. But he uses the term moral landscape by saying that, well, these things are more better than these things which are less good, right? And that in that, that it can point in general directions. Mm-hmm. You know, so for the example, we can sit there and say, in a historical perspective, is slavery moral or not? Well, if you go back and you look at your history, at the time, the philosophical debate was quite up in the air, and there were arguments on both sides. But when you looked at the empirical evidence on the ground, when you actually said, well, what does the science show us? Well, science showed that some people who were in slavery were less well off than those people who were out of slavery. Mm-hmm. And that this provided us a foundation or a grounding for ethical decision-making.
Especially in the case of slavery, because part of the philosophical argument going on at the time was still questioning whether or not the black slaves were even human, when scientifically, empirically speaking, of course they were. But by rejecting the scientific basis for that, you opened the door for very questionable moral opinions on philosophy's side.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I to show a bias here, I'm a big proponent of what they call experimental philosophy. Now, I don't think all philosophy can be done experimentally, but I think as we gain greater insights into neurology, into the physical world, a lot of the questions that were just by necessity thought experiments can actually become real experiments. And one of the growing area, and again, one of the things that Sam Harris sort of points out as three ways that this adventure can go, is explaining why do people think things are moral or immoral, right? You know, what is the actual going on? And this is sort of the is part of it, right? But having understood the way things are, it can then sit there and say, well, you know, now that we know why you think something is moral or immoral, we can now sort of say, well, what should be it? If you think something is moral because it promotes good, and he does take a rather utilitarian point of view on his arguments, but I would argue, to go on aside, that almost all philosophies of morals or ethics are utilitarian. They just disagree, of course, on how to do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, even Kant, who's a strictly rules-based thing, well, why do you follow the rules? Because if you follow these rules, in the end, you will have a much better world for everyone to live on. If everyone lied, well, there would be no truth. There'd be no, you know, there'd be no point to telling the truth. So you shouldn't lie because it makes the world a better place, ultimately. Even if you don't do what a true utilitarian would do and say, well, should I lie in this particular instance or not? Which is, so if you sit there and you say, well, the whole point of morality and ethics is to create wellness or well-being in people and in society, then again, science can say, well, this particular activity will help promote well-being or not. For example, one of the things that I was looking at was the idea of poverty. And Christopher Hitchens did a great book about Mother Teresa. Well, not a good book for her, because he kind of tore her a new one, if I may use that phrase, where the idea that poverty can be a good thing. And philosophically, you can make some really good arguments that, you know, we shouldn't be tied to our possessions, that we should have a, you know, degree of independence from the material world. We should look for value greater than in things. And I would agree with that. But if you just leave it to philosophy, you get someone like Mother Teresa who saw that poverty was in itself a good, and you should try and promote poverty to a degree in people. And what degree do you promote it? You know, poverty includes things like malnutrition, which leads, of course, to stunted growth, to impaired cognitive ability. So, you know, even if you agree with the idea that we shouldn't be tied to material goods, science will help define where the moral landscape is by saying, well, these things actually promote wellness and these things don't. And I've been throwing around the term wellness, and I think I should go back and I should kind of define what wellness is, because everyone will also tend to say that science is, you know, binary. You know, it, either a quirk is on or it's off. Either it's, you know, a chemical reaction will happen or it won't happen. And that when you do something like ethics, it's more of an art. Well, if you look at human health, as in your physical health, well, that is also kind of an art. I mean, science can tell us that if you eat, as I said before, more green vegetables and less red fatty meat, right, that helps define parameters. And I mean, the better we get at our science, the more well-defined those parameters can be. But it still at least points us in certain directions we should be going and tells us these are other directions we shouldn't be going in. So if we sit there and we say, well, okay, you should eat more vegetables. Well, that's the science part. Where's the art? Well, which vegetables should you be eating? You know, Ethan likes broccoli and I like Brussels sprouts. So, I mean, it's not that if we follow this path of science leading to ethics that we are somehow chaining ourselves. We're giving up our sense of freedom or free choice. It just says, you know, these are the things that would help promote wellness. And it even helps us define the idea of what, you know, we often in our society think killing people is immoral, but we still will do it, right? So, I mean, at least it also tells us, okay, we're not dictated to be moral, but at least we know where that landscape is.
Right. And one point that he continually makes is that his moral landscape is not it's not a straight line. It's this peak and valley based system where you have good points, bad points, and they're not all, you know, one big mountain of goodness at the top and badness at the bottom. There's sort of like this mountain range of goodness at the top and badness in the valleys.
Yeah, no, and again, with the idea that you know, our science isn't well developed in these areas. It's a growing, neurology is less than what, 30, 40 years old of any kind of degree, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, how exactly we define what are good brain states is hard to say. And some people also will complain about the idea of subjectivity and objectivity. Well, again, using this idea of health as a metaphor, and Sam Harris has used it quite a bit, we can objectively inspect subjective things. For example, how many people out there feel depressed and depression? Well, that's a very subjective matter, right? But it's also a very real mental condition. So we can objectively look at someone's claim of the subjective experience of depression and use that to help make them better, to make their wellness increase. In the same way that we can do the same thing for moral landscapes. He kicks a lot, obviously, on religion, right? But he doesn't do so equally. So I think in Sam Harris's view, he'd see something like female genital mutilation as a deep valley. But as I say, you know, poverty. What do they call it? Anyhow, to be poor, right, as sort of a part of your religious thing. Well, that's not a valley. That might be, you know, in the middle, right? And to treat one's fellow man as yourself and to be generous to others might be on a higher level. And now each religion may do it in its own slight way, right? And I'm not trying to promote religion here, but I'm trying to give them the best case possible. Good philosophers always give their opponents the best case possible. But so even within those traditions, even if you reject them all, they have peaks and valleys within them. I mean, we were talking earlier today. I mean, how can someone kill another human being because of some words that he said? You know, empirically, you can sit there and say, that's nuts. There is evidence that the wellness you have, that the badness, the harm you've done to this person greatly outweighs the harm he could possibly have done to you. And again, it becomes an empirical question. Another area that I thought was kind of interesting, and I don't remember him saying as much about this, but my memory gets a little foggy, is a third area that science can help is how do we persuade people to try and do the right thing. And part of this, again, is just to understand human psychology. One of the great experiments, I was talking to a friend of mine the other day, was about the fat man on the train. Now, this is a very classic example, right, where you start off and you ask people the question. Train is going down a track and you're at a switch. If you pull the switch, the train goes left and kills five people. You push it to the right, it kills one person, right? Now, right now, it's going to kill five people. Do you pull the switch or not? And most people say, yes, I'll flip the switch. It's sad one person dies, but, you know, at least five other people will live. Then they rework the experiment and say, well, you're on a bridge and a train's going underneath you and the train is about to kill five people. But you're with a very large individual who, if you push off the bridge, will block the train and save the five people. Of course, it will kill the large individual, but, you know, most people will say, no, I won't do it then. And this is where science looks at human psychology and say, well, why is there a difference? I mean, philosophically, there is no difference at all. But psychologically, neurologically, it makes a huge difference. And science can help us understand why we make these delineations, right? I was thinking of a term, and I must admit, I don't know if anyone's done any research into this, but I was watching a show, Horizon, called Seeing is Believing. And its whole thing was about optical illusions. Well, I wonder how many moral illusions there are in the world. How many times have we done things thinking we're doing a moral act, but it's sort of illusionary, you know? I mean, like giving a crack dealer, because we're talking about drugs, right? Giving him $20 to go out and buy more drugs. Well, is that a moral thing or not, you know? And you may have the illusion that it is, but again, this is one of those areas where, you know, science can say, well, we can objectively measure degrees of wellness, and these are the scales by which we might be able to look at this particular question.
Why don't we take a commercial break here, come back with a bit more on the moral landscape.
Stewie, hey.
Hey there. So, it's been 24 hours. Got my money?
Oh, you know what? Just give me till next Friday. I'll have it for you.
Oh, that's funny. I could have sworn I said have it today.
Yeah, I don't have it. Sorry.
Oh, well, all right then. That's good, OJ.
Ah! Ah!
Yeah, that hurt?
Ah!
That hurt?
What the hell?
Yeah,
ah!
It feels so good, does it?
Ah!
No,
ah!
Huh?
Oh! Ah!
Yeah.
CITR would like to thank everyone who donated their time, love, and money to Fund Drive 2010. The money raised goes directly into the operating costs of keeping our station on the air. To thank you for your donation, we have prizes that are waiting for you here. If you have not yet picked up your prizes, now is the time. Come down to CITR World Headquarters in room 233 of the Student Union Building on UBC campus between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. Monday to Friday.
You got till 5 o'clock, you hear me? You got till 5 o'clock!
You freaking psychopath!
Clean yourself up.
Pay your pledge. Get your prizes. It's that simple.
And we're back. So, we've been talking about, you know, can science be a window onto ethical and moral choices? And I think around this table, we've convinced anyone. Ethan, are you convinced? Can you come up with any quandaries, questions?
Well, you know, I guess to be honest, I've kind of agreed with Sam Harris's point of view for a while now. I mean, I've talked in the past about how a relativistic view is not just limited to philosophy. It's managed to infect a lot of the social sciences that I happen to really enjoy, especially history. There's been far too many occasions when I've heard things like, you know, the scientific imperialistic point of view is just one way of knowing the world. Another way of knowing the world is just making stuff up, apparently. And, you know, it's very frustrating to me as someone who believes in the scientific method as a way of accurately understanding the universe to have to hear people say that science is just a biased lens used by, you know, Western society to dominate the world. But, you know, what does Harris have to say about that kind of stuff?
A good point. I'm not sure. but I know what I would say with regards to that. In fact, I was having a conversation with a friend of mine a little while ago, and I think I might have talked about it with you, about one of the things about science is that science itself is sort of neutral. It's designed, actually, to be objective and independent. Now, scientists can be very, very biased and very, very general, but the method itself eventually will sort of, you know, prove its way through. We were talking about earlier today about Neanderthals and all that, and there are some things that are going to go off the rails in times. For example, it was the whole eugenics of Nazi Germany that led people down. They tried to apply a scientific method. They did it horribly, but, I mean, they tried to apply the idea of a scientific method to do their one solution. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, because of that, or in spite of that, we have learned, you know, that there are some limitations, that you have to interpret things in an honest way, not through ideological lenses, that, you know, the scientists who were, quote-unquote, doing good science weren't really doing good science. I mean, for example, you can apply the term science to almost anything. There are creation scientists out there.
Sure.
Who don't actually let the evidence dictate the research. They have a conclusion and they try and backmask it. I think on that sort of note is the idea that everyone sort of assumes that science is in itself ideological, that it has one answer and only one answer. And in one sense, there are certain questions where there are. I mean, you know, the weight of an electron will have, barring quantum mechanics, one weight, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe that was a horrible example to use. Any quantum physicists out there, please excuse me. But there are other areas, again, where things are not quite as gray, are not quite as
black and white.
Black and white. And science doesn't have a problem. I mean, we were talking about human health before, right? You know, there are things that we know promote health, and some things that don't. But how much does it promote depends on the person, depends on the situation. So even though you know this is a good direction to be going in, it's not saying you have to go this particular direction. And I think there are some areas, again, based on the limitations of our modern science, what is the most perfect color? Well, maybe there is. Maybe science will say this is a totally indeterminate or non-contributing factor to wellness. So there is no answer to that. I mean, science doesn't have to be a shackle that limits us. It's designed to be a light to enlighten our path, to help show us the direction to go. And I know I'm beating this metaphor to death, but going back to that, science may show us what is a good diet. And we may ignore that science, and we can eat a bad diet. But at least when we do so, we know that there are health costs involved. So in the same sense that science may tell us that if we have blasphemy laws and we execute people for saying words, we can still do that. We are still free in that sense. But we have evidence to show that this is a bad thing and creates a worse world than if we didn't do it. Mm-hmm. So it just is. Science is a great tool for us to learn and to understand the world around us, and it is not innately a ball and chain that will suddenly enslave us any more than, like I say, knowing that vegetables are good for you and cheesecake tastes good but isn't good for you.
Yeah. You know, another aspect that Harris mentions is the notion that science is not at the stage where it can be an absolute authority, but that's no reason to dismiss what we've already gained. And, I mean, it's also important to remember that I don't think Harris makes the case that science right now is at the point to be an absolute authority. He's not making that case. He's very clear that science, when it enters the moral landscape, is going to enter it in baby steps. And we've barely entered it at this stage. I mean, let's face it, modern science is only a couple hundred years old. And it's not going to be something that just you flick a light and suddenly we understand everything. It's going to take a while. And there's going to be different perspectives. But the fact that science embraces, you know, new ideas, that the method is good at determining what is the best answer, I don't think there's any reason to dismiss science from this field.
And I think that goes to the actual heart of the message of the moral landscape, is what he's actually fighting against isn't so much to promote science and ethics, which he thinks will eventually come just as the science promotes, but this dogmatic rejection that somehow ethics and morality are some special sacred purview to which evidence and the scientific method must be excluded. And that's what he's saying. He's saying, no, you know, sure, science may have very little to say right now about ethics and morality. That's a debatable issue, but he's just saying we should be open to say that it can and that we should be looking for these insights that are available and not just rejecting it out of hand. He goes into, he spends a lot of the early part of his book, from what I remember, talking about intellectuals doing intellectual jiu-jitsu to accommodate both morality and relativism, and somehow seeing that genital female mutilation isn't wrong in its cultural context. And you just, it's mind-numbing.
Yeah, it really is. Well, why don't we move on to our skeptical highlights, as we're sort of running out of time here on Radio Free Thinker. Some interesting ones coming up. Tomorrow we have Skeptics in the Pub in Kitsilano, which is Wednesday, January 5th, 7:30, over at the Billy Bishop Legion on 1407 Laburnum Street, which is here in Vancouver. So come by, check it out. Should be a good time. The next day, CFI Vancouver is having our year-end general meeting on the 6th at 7 p.m., which is going to be in room 317 over at the Irving K. Berber Library. If you're a volunteer with CFI, or would you like to be a volunteer with CFI, please join us for this meeting to discuss the events of last year, things that we liked, that we didn't like, what we want to do in 2011, and it should be a very interesting, interesting evening. That's at 7 o'clock at the Irving K. Berber Library. And of course, if you happen to enjoy today's discussion on Sam Harris, well, remember to come by on Saturday the 8th when for CFI's book club, which we are reading Sam Harris's The Moral Landscape. So we can dive into it. It's going to be a lot of fun. It'll be at 1 p.m. at the Grind Cafe on Main Street. And again, I cannot recommend it enough.
Now, I'm going to put you on the spot here, Ethan.
Okay.
Now, CFI is promoting this book club event.
Mm-hmm.
And we just did a show on the book club event. And a number of our listeners will probably attend both. And I would like to revisit this whole area of mm-hmm. ethics and science based upon the feedback that people who will watch both shows and say, Dawn, what the hell were you talking about? I read the book and I didn't get that. Or someone said, hey, I saw this in the book. And I'd really like to get a bit of feedback. I'd like for us to have actually a viewer show on the whole idea of ethics and science, and can the two, can science shed light on ethics? And I think if you had any ideas on that, you can go to radiofreethinker.com or email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com and let us know. And I'm sure Ethan will promote this at the books. Are you going to be at the book?
Yeah, I plan on being
there. You have to be.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I mean, it's a good point. I would like to get some feedback. I mean, I'm sure not everybody agrees with what Sam Harris has written. So you know what? Maybe we can get some really good feedback and perhaps on a future show revisit the moral landscape.
That would be
good.
Scaptaculous.
That would be fantastic. Well, we're pretty much out of time here on the show. So this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver, saying thanks for listening.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
And we'll be back next week, hopefully with the rest of our cast here on the show. Not that me and Don can't, you know, anchor the show, because we can, but
No, we've always anchored the show.
Oh, yeah.
But we can have the other talent on as well.
Yeah. It would be good if they were here. Well, see you next week, folks. Bye-bye.
Stewie. Hey.
Hey there. So,